this week together in prayer. God, take us exactly where we are and exactly who we are. And have your spirits be with us and among us. Open us up to the word before us. Amen. So yesterday, a group of 11 of us gathered at the Mallets Bay United Church of Christ for a leadership retreat. Now, this was new for us in this church, or at least it was new again. And it began with a conversation that we had at council a few months ago, where we decided to invite our church officers and the representatives from our various ministries and our community liaisons, those who help us keep connected to the wider community, and agreed to gather together for a day of eating and talking and worship and thinking about our church's future. We were joined by the Reverend Barbara Lemmel, who is a consultant from the United Methodist Church, and she helped us as we talked about our church's past. She helped us take a good long look at the church as we are today, and she helped us to think a little bit more about where God is calling us to go in the future. It was a blessing to be there among those folks and to listen with them and to worship with them and to eat with them and to hear what they had to say. It was just a blessing in so many different ways. The hardest part for me, though, about the leadership retreat, and we talked about this at council a few times as well, but the hardest thing for me was picking which leaders to invite. I mean, who exactly is a leader in our church anyway? Is it the church officers? Is it the ministry chairs? And if we invite the ministry chair, should we invite all the people who serve on our various ministries? What about our Sunday school teachers and our choir and our program staff? Who exactly is a leader in our church anyway? And what about the new folks among us? Wouldn't their voices be valuable to hear in such a setting? Who is a leader in this church? Well, we decided to invite our officers, like I said, and our ministry chairs and our community liaisons, and there were 25 people on our list, and 11 came, which is almost a perfect biblical number, and is absolutely fantastic for a small group setting like we had, and to do the work that we needed to do, that was a really ideal number. Now, even though we had an ideal number yesterday, it did not include all of the leaders in the church, and I don't mean to say that in an accusatory way, as if to say, you're a leader, and you work there, and you know who you are. It's not what I mean at all. What I mean to say is that I believe very deeply in the idea of the priesthood or the ministry of all believers, which is to say that by virtue of following Jesus Christ, by virtue of your baptism, you are called to use the gifts that God has given you for the sake of the gospel and for the life of the world. This makes you a leader, you see. As Martin Luther King Jr. famously said in his letter from the Birmingham City Jail, he talked about the church as being a thermometer sometimes, which registers the cultural temperature. But he called the church to be more than that, to be a thermostat, somebody, individuals and a church as a whole who doesn't only register the cultural temperature, but who helps to change the temperature. Interesting idea to keep in your mind. So maybe this is why we had such a hard time trying to determine who to invite to our leadership retreat. Because really, all of us here this morning are leaders. And all of us belong in Mallets Bay yesterday. Well, like many things in life, there's this gap, right, between what we're called to do and what we're equipped to do. Right? So you can be baptized as a baby in our church, but you're really not in a position to be a faithful and effective Christian leader. So it's a task in the church, I think, an ongoing task for us to help develop leaders and to help one another develop into the best leaders that we can possibly be. So because of the leadership retreat yesterday, in light of our baptism, and in light of the fact that all of us could use some leadership development, I want to take some time this morning to think about the life of Moses, who the Bible holds up as one of the best leaders ever to have lived. Our passage this morning from Deuteronomy 34, verses 1 through 12, comes at the very end of Moses' life. And that passage serves for us as sort of an obituary and a eulogy, even. So, just to catch us up a little bit, you may remember this from last week, that Moses has been wandering in the desert for 40 years with his people, after being freed from slavery in Egypt. And so, finally, they reach the promised land. And so Moses goes up to the top of Mount Nebo, and he looks north, and he looks south, and he looks east, and he looks west, and he sees all of the land that God had promised to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants. Must have been a powerful moment for him. The Bible doesn't tell us, but I imagine he was weepy. I imagine that he was overcome. He had waited so long for this moment, and he finally gets to see the promise. But we've known for many chapters now in Deuteronomy that Moses won't be allowed into the promised land. You see, for some reasons I don't have time to get into this morning, God had told Moses that he could see the promised land, but God would not allow him to enter the promised land. So there on top of Mount Nebo, it was a bittersweet moment, right? Because he was ready for his people to inherit the land, but he himself wouldn't be able to go there. Well, it's in this bittersweet and beautiful moment we're told that Moses simply dies and is buried in an unmarked grave. Deuteronomy ends with the following words. And just to note that not only does Deuteronomy end with these words, but also the five books of Moses, also called the Pentateuch, end with these words. Never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. He was unequaled for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt, against Pharaoh and all his servants and his entire land, and for all the mighty deeds and all the terrifying displays of power that Moses performed in the sight of all his people. Quite a eulogy, quite a summary of his life, and I think it's a way of saying to us, Moses was important. Moses was worth remembering. Moses was someone to look at and look at again and to try to follow in our own lives. So this morning, I want to take just a little bit of time to hold up Moses and his life and to extract from the stories of his life some leadership principles that we can use in our lives and in our church to do the things that God is calling us to do. Moses lived 120 years, we're told. And we have been following his story since birth in Exodus all the way to his death at the end of Deuteronomy. So there's lots of stories about him and lots of sort of principles to pull out, but there are six in particular that I think are helpful for us and for you to think about in terms of your own leadership, what it means to be faithful and effective. The first leadership principle that I find in Moses' life is the principle of feel the fear and do it anyway. Now, when Moses met God at the burning bush, books before, God told Moses that he was to go to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh and to free the Israelites from bondage there. And so Moses does what we all would do, right? And says, absolutely not. That is work, that is difficult, that is scary, absolutely not. He says, who am I? That's his first protest. And then he says, no one's going to listen to me, God. And then he says, I'm not a very good speaker anyway. And finally, when he's run out of all the excuses, he just simply says, no, you've absolutely just got to find somebody else. Moses is reluctant, and he's afraid, and he says no more than once. But see, God persists. And eventually, Moses decides that he's going to do what God asks of him. And so he does. And he goes to Pharaoh, and finally, the Israelites are freed. And we move on a trajectory all the way to Mount Nebo and the inheritance of the promised land. So the first leadership principle that we see in Moses' life is to feel the fear and to do it anyway. Most of the world's best leaders have been reluctant to be able. The second leadership principle that I think is helpful for us to think about this morning is the principle of shared leadership. Sometimes, maybe even most of the time, when we get power, we want to hold on to it for ourselves. Right? We want the glory, we want the success, we want the money that comes along with power. And so, in the very early days when the Israelites are wandering through the desert, Moses is serving as a judge of the people. And when there's problems and quarrels and things that need to be decided, they go to Moses and they ask him for some sort of judgment or some sort of way forward to figure out the mess that they were in. So he's doing this. He's doing it from sun up to sundown. He's doing it a lot and spending all of his time doing it. Well, he's visited by his father-in-law, Jethro, who observes what Moses is doing and how difficult it is and how taxing it is. And he takes Moses aside at the end of the day and says, this isn't good for you. This isn't good for the people. You've got to find some help here. So Moses could have said, no way, man, this is my game, this is my thing, I'm in control. But he doesn't do that. So he calls on some capable people, some trustworthy people, some faithful people, and he sets them up as judges too. So that Moses has help, so that Moses doesn't burn out, so that other wisdom is brought into the fold, and that the people are allowed to grow and thrive. So in Moses' life, we see the principle of shared leadership. Third principle that we see in Moses' life is the principle of vision. Of vision. It was hours, maybe days after the Israelites had been freed from slavery that they're wandering in the desert and they are hungry and they are tired and they are afraid and they are at risk. And so what do? They immediately turn around and they look back to where they had come from. The golden age of slavery. And they grumble and they complain to Moses and they say, you know what, we're going to die here in the desert. At least back in Egypt we had meat in our bowls. So Moses hears the real needs. These are real needs that people have. And Moses and God talk about some things and God decides to send them manna and quail in the desert so that the people have food to eat. And see, it's through that that the people turn away from Egypt finally. To see the vision that Moses and God are holding out before them, and by caring for the real needs of real people, Moses is allowed to help the people move forward to the vision and to the promised land. So good leaders have vision and can help the people practically move towards that vision. The fourth principle is the principle of future generations. I said that Moses knew that he wasn't allowed to enter into the promised land, but he doesn't get frustrated and take his toys and go home. He doesn't try to undermine God or the Israelites in their journey. He doesn't try to make himself feel better by making other people feel worse. He works as hard as he can to prepare and equip the people for success in the future when he is gone. And so as we talked about last week, he gives them the Ten Commandments. And he reminds them to keep God's commandments and laws, and he gives them the Shema, hear, O Israel. So even though Moses has a bittersweet moment, even though he's probably individually very sad that he can't enter the promised land, that doesn't stop him from preparing future generations for the success that they will need. And so the principle he shows us is the principle of future generations. Related to that one is the fifth principle. And that's the principle of future leadership. You see, it's hard when we have power to give that power over to other people, especially when we know that our time is ending. Sometimes we try to hold on to that as long as we possibly can, and that can create divides as our leadership transitions into the next generation or to the next cycle. So we're told in verses 10 and 11, though, that at the end of his life, that Moses lays hands on Joshua. He ordains Joshua, who is to be their leader in the promised land. And in ordaining him and laying hands on him, three things happen, I think. First of all, we're told that he imparts the wisdom of the Spirit to Joshua. Joshua is equipped and given the things that he's going to need to be a successful leader. Secondly, the people see Moses ordaining Joshua. And so his leadership is legitimized. People say, hey, Moses was a good leader. Now Joshua is the new leader that we can follow. He has a continuity of leadership that he does because in a ceremonial way, he has that leadership string continue. And the third thing it does, think about Joshua. What must that have felt like to have leader of Moses' stature lay his hands on Joshua and say, you are now the God. Think about the courage that he was given because of that. And in the days ahead, I have to imagine that that helped him a great deal. So the fifth principle that we see of Moses' leadership is the principle of future leadership. Finally, the sixth principle, which we get at the very end, where we're told that Moses was the one who God knew face to face. It's at the very end of our story, at the very end of Moses' life, as if to say all that came before it is framed and made legitimate by that one particular proclamation. You see, in the day, seeing God face to face would mean strength. Because God was thought to be so powerful that just looking upon God's face that you would die. But here we have this claim that Moses is the one who God knew face to face. Maybe this is just my sort of modern Protestantism kind of creeping in here, but to me that sounds a whole lot like a personal relationship. That Moses knew God and that God knew Moses. And that is probably the most important lesson that we can glean from Moses. That he is the one who God knew, and that Moses knew God. So, the six principles as we have them, I don't expect you to remember them, but six principles are the principle of feel the fear and do it anyway, the principle of shared leadership, the principle of vision, the principle of future generations, of future leadership, and finally, walking with God face to face. It's a lot of information to remember. And I imagine that you may have the question on your mind this morning, the question or the questions of who? Me? Is it even me who is called to be a leader? You know, you might be thinking, I've got a mortgage and a yard to mow and the snow is coming and I've got some things to do outside of it. I have kids and I've got a job. I have all of these demands in my life. Am I really called to be a leader in the church? Am I really called to be a leader by virtue of my baptism? And if I am, do I even have time for that? So to that question or those questions of who, me, there's good news and there's bad news. I'll start with the bad news. The bad news, maybe it's bad. You might perceive it that way, but we'll see. The bad news is that the answer to the questions of who, me, are a big, fat, yes, you. Even you. You see, in the church, leadership isn't something that experts are supposed to do. Leadership isn't something for other people to do, but that all of us are called to be thermostats, and all of us are called to use what God has given us for the sake of the gospel. Who, me, yes, you. Our nominating committee would be happy to hear me say that this morning as they look for people, even in our church at this time, who could fill some very real needs that we have in this church. The good news, and I'll end with this morning. The good news is this. That as difficult as Christian leadership can be, as reluctant as we may be to take on the mantle of that leadership at the end of the day is a blessing. It's a blessing for us as individuals, as a community, and as a whole world. It's a blessing for us as individuals because when we do that which God calls us to do, when we are in sync and in step with God, that brings us peace and it brings us joy and it brings us power. So living into our call to be Christian leaders is a blessing. It's a blessing for our communities as well, but because when we show leadership as an individual or as a whole church, that translates into things happening in the community, things like the hungry being fed, like the poor being clothed and housed, like advocacy for the least among us. Powerful ministry starts to happen in our community because we're a group of leaders. And lastly, and more broadly, Christian leadership is a blessing not only to us as individuals and as a community, but to the whole world. Because as thousands and millions of Christian leaders go about their using their skills and are in sync with God, we become partners in God's work to put the whole world back together again. Christian leadership is a blessing to us, to the community, and to the whole world. Who, me, we ask. Yes, even you. Thanks be to God for that. We'll close this morning with this prayer. God of Moses and of us, take us busy, tired, ill-equipped, and reluctant people as your own. Help us to become good leaders. Help us to become good leaders. Help us to become good leaders, that we might be blessed, that this church might be blessed, and that in Christ's name, the whole world will be blessed.